time for another episode of Farm Talk with Washington County Agricultural Extension Agent Phil Blevins, and we have a very, very special show today. He's going to be taking all kinds of questions, and I've decided that we're playing Stump the Ag Agent, and here he is now.
That might not be too hard to do, but it's good to be back with everyone today. And I'll have to say thank you to my wife on the air today, because I almost was here and realized that I'd forgot my notes for today, and so I just barely got in here. She brought them to me, but I wouldn't be much if it wasn't for her. So it is good to be here, and we had a question last week on the show that a listener called in and we actually missed, and I apologize for that, and I wanted to expand on that a little bit. We were talking about poisonous plants, and this individual had asked if any of these plants are poisonous to pets. And so at the very end, I mentioned a family of plants called aroid, that's A-R-O-I-D, and they can cause problems with pets. And some of those, if they eat them, and a lot of them are grown as house plants, so they pose a special threat to pets. And some of those include things like philodendron, which is a pretty common house plant that can create a problem. Others, jack in the pulpit, which I remember when I was a kid, we'd find those growing wild in the woods. But then elephant ears, that's another one that's grown as a common house plant. And all the parts of the plant are toxic. The toxin in it is calcium oxalate, and it causes a painful swelling of the mouth and throat. And so even a small child, if they were to happen to be curious and eat a piece of it, they can suffer a speech impediment for several days. Some other plants that are poisonous to pets would include amaryllis, and in contact with the sap or other parts of the plant can cause a skin rash. And then castor bean, or mole bean as it's referred to locally, they're extremely toxic. And if an animal happens to eat the seed or something of that nature, what happens then is ricin is the chemical in it that causes the toxic problem or the poisoning, and that prevents cells from making proteins that are essential for body functions. And so the symptoms usually develop in 12 to 48 hours, and they'll include things like excessive thirst, loss of appetite and coordination, and weakness and difficulty breathing, among other symptoms, and even small amounts can be lethal to pets. Two more, daylily, that's one that's toxic to cats. They're extremely toxic, and so keep an eye on that. And then we talked about Japanese yew, and it's how toxic it is to livestock, but it is to animals as well, and all parts of it are. And even if you have children, if you have yew bushes in your yard, be careful that they don't pick the red berries off of it, because if they swallow those seeds, those are extremely toxic. So, like I said last week, that's not a reason to run and get rid of every plant you've got that has any potential for a toxin in it, but just be careful with them. And to avoid poisonings, you know, make sure your animals are well fed. If you've got a curious animal that just seems like to chew on everything, keep an eye on them. Avoid feeding your neighbor's livestock shrub trimmings. Just don't do that. And if those of you that have cattle or sheep or horses, scout any new grazing areas you're going to turn them on to make sure there's really no real threats out there, and avoid any highly toxic plants. And also realize that herbicide treatment can increase palatability. So I just wanted to go back to that question because we missed it last week, and I think we've got another question or two, don't we, Ivy?
We do, and if you are tuned in and want to ask Phil something today, it's a very free-ranging show. Give us a call at 276-944-6933. And apropos of that last question, you have another one that says, what plant pairings deter insects and predators such as deer and rabbits?
Okay, that's a good question. And some of the plants, there is a list of plants that are deer resistant. I don't have all those in my head. I could get that to you if you would send me an email at pblevins@vt.edu. But because you have a plant there that the deer are resistant to, don't mean they'll eat the one that's with it, that's not deer resistant. So keep that in mind. As far as insects, well, rabbits the same way. You know, rabbits, if you have young apple trees, for example, rabbits can be extremely damaging to young apple trees by chewing the bark off of the tree at the base. And so one of the ways to avoid that if you plant young trees is either to take a piece of corrugated pipe about a foot, something like that in length, and split it and put it around the tree, or take a 2-liter soft drink bottle and cut the top out of it and split it, take the bottom out too and put it around the tree. And rabbits don't generally raise up on their back legs to eat, and so that'll stop that problem. You could also use that longer pieces of that if you have bigger trees, or even chicken wire to keep buck deer from rubbing their antlers on it and tearing the bark off of it. But now, as far as insects go, there are some things that some people use, like marigolds. They'll use marigolds around plants that have some resistance to insects. But keep in mind, those kinds of things are not a surefired way of getting rid of anything, because once, for example, deer get used to something, if you could stand still enough in your garden for long enough, the deer would get used to you and come in and eat it anyhow. So once they get accustomed to something, sometimes they come anyhow.
Well, and while we're still talking about deer, I've just recently cleared off some land at the back of my property, so it kind of opens up, and it was just all scrubby and full of brush and vines and things. And before, I'd come home and count 25, 30 deer in the yard, and now I don't see any. Are they just kind of temporarily dislocated, or can I hope that there might be less now?
There's probably not less, but it could be because you changed the landscape some that they're just staying back further away from the property. But, you know, as plants grow back that are appealing to them, you'll probably start seeing them again. Really, the only sure way to keep deer out of an area that you don't want them in is to fence it with deer fencing. And that can be either fence that's really tall or fence that's three-dimensional. And there are plans out there to make three-dimensional fence, which we used around some of our experimental plots to keep deer out of. And generally, they work well, you know, unless the deer are running. If the deer are running when they get to them, they run through them anyhow. But if it's just those deer that casually come onto your property, a three-dimensional electrified fence does a pretty good job of discouraging them, because they don't have good depth perception. They don't know how far to jump, so they tend not to jump it. Now, but if you just put a 4-foot fence around your garden, they're just going to hop over it. So that's a good question.
We got a call coming in. Let me grab this.
All right.
Hello, you are on Farm Talk. What's your question?
My question is, this time of year, it seems like every year, I see a number of instances with people that have crepe myrtles in their yard, and they cut them back to where there's hardly anything left except, you know, 3 or 4 feet of the bare trunk of the tree. And I wonder if this is actually good for the trees. Is it something that you should do, or is it something that you should avoid that's just gotten to be a common practice?
Well, the ones that I'm familiar with on the crepe myrtle, the ones you see particularly in landscape plantings, generally aren't treated that way. That's a good question. I'm not sure I know why they would cut them all the way back, unless it's to get them to regenerate or something, or maybe there's some practice associated with that I'm not familiar with. So I better not go too deep into why they do that. And sometimes, sometimes plants are pruned in ways they shouldn't be. Now, I'm not saying that's the case with crepe myrtle, but it may be a practice that's happened over the years, and I'll try to investigate that a little better and maybe have a better answer for that next week. But most of the ones that I see, for example, that municipalities and others plant in medians and in landscape areas, they are pruned, but they keep some shape to them so that there's some foliage there and some bloom and things like that during the season. But I'll try to come up with a better answer than that before our next program.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And if you are listening in, please give us a call. Phil will be happy to try to answer your questions the best way he can. And the number is 276-944-6933. And you do have another question about what's involved in getting organic certification.
Okay, I guess you could say there's different levels of organic certification. I mean, I can claim to grow things organically, and I can grow them organically, for example, using non-synthetic fertilizers, using no synthetic chemicals or things like that. But on the official level, if you go to USDA Organic Certification, there's a process that you have to go through to do that. And it's a pretty involved process. You have to have a certifier, an official certifier, come to your property to certify that. And they're going to ask some questions like what you've used on your land in the last 2 or 3 years. Has there been synthetic fertilizers used on it? And some other questions like that that you're going to have to answer to their satisfaction to qualify for that. And then there's a list of products that you can use that's called OMRI certified, O-M-R-I, that you would have to abide by to be able to claim official USDA organic certification. And then once you've done that, a lot of, it's not necessarily part of the certification, but a lot of buyers that you would have to deal with if you were selling produce, for example, would expect you to go through what's called GAP certification or Good Agricultural Practice certification, which is another involved process. So you can go to USDA's organic certification website and find out really the details on that, which would be too lengthy to go over on a radio program. But there's good information there. And also through the Virginia Department of Agriculture or USDA, you could come up with a list of certifiers, and there's an expense involved with that. They're going to charge you to come and certify your farm or your land for organic certification. So it's not something that you just do online and it doesn't cost you anything. So keep that in mind. It's fairly pricey to get that done. All right. So here's another question. Should folks be worried about cicadas with the emergence this year on their fruit trees and in their gardens? Well, there is supposed to be a huge hatch of different broods of cicadas this year, and that'll happen before long. And so these broods are interesting because these broods are numbered. There's 13-year and there's 17-year cicadas. And they, when they do emerge in mass, it's a pretty big deal because if you're living near the forest where these things emerge, it's a huge racket and aggravates people. But the way they damage plants, they're a big problem for trees. It's not that they kill the trees necessarily, but when they lay their eggs in the ends of the branches, for lack of a better way to explain it, and you'll see after they've done that is the female stings, I guess. That's not necessarily the right way to say it, but they insert their ovipositor into the end of the limb. And it ruptures the bark of the tree a little bit there. And you'll see these dead limbs flagging or ends of the branches flagging in the woods. There'll be brown limb ends hanging everywhere in the woods. And that's where the eggs have been laid. And then these hatch and fall to the ground and go into the ground and pupate. And that's where they are from now till 13 or 17 years from now. So as far as the garden goes, there's probably not a lot to worry about. But now if you have fruit trees in your yard, you ought to keep an eye on it. They're not exceptionally hard to kill, so you can kill them with an insecticide. You just need to keep an eye on it when you begin to hear them or begin to see them, to keep your tree sprayed, to keep them from damaging particularly young fruit trees on the ends of the limbs, and which could cause some significant damage to them. Large trees, probably not such a big deal. I'm sure that there could be individual cases where you could get enough in a tree to damage it, but I'm not aware of it ever being something that's lethal to a tree to do that. But on a young tree, it could be a problem. There's a number of insecticides you could use, like Seven or a Permethrin product. But keep in mind, they don't last long. They degrade really quickly in the environment. So you'll kind of like a Japanese beetle thing. You'll have to spray when you see them there. And fortunately, they don't last long. They're aggravating while they're here, but they don't last long. And I hope that answers the question. If it doesn't, we'll just call in or email and we'll see if we can clarify that. All right.
Well, I'm certain that you have gotten some mighty interesting questions from folks who haven't necessarily called into the station.
Yeah, and I've got a couple of things today. I don't know how far we'll get with it. Before we go to that, you want to take a break, Ivy, and then we'll come back and answer a couple of questions I get at the office.
People Incorporated is asking for your help in collecting personal hygiene supplies for residents of the agency's permanent supportive housing programs, including donations of mops, brooms and dustpans, toilet paper and paper towels, cleaning products, tampons and pads, body washes, shampoo and toothpaste and more, as well as cost-cutter gift certificates for haircuts. Donations can be dropped off at People Incorporated's headquarters at 1173 West Main Street in Avignon. Items will be collected from now until May 1st.
This is WEHC Emory and WISE FM Wise. We return now for more Farm Talk, and here is Phil Blevins.
Okay, we were talking about some questions. Again, one of the issues that's going around now that I thought I'd mention briefly, and that's the avian flu situation. I'm sure you've, if you watch the news, you've seen on the news that they've found it in a few cases in dairy cattle in different, about nine states scattered around the country. And unfortunately, sometimes you have people in the news that try to sensationalize it and make it a deal that it's not. And so this flu actually has been a bigger deal in the poultry industry, because a poultry house gets infected, they have to be euthanized and disposed of. It was originally found in dairy cattle. That's the only cattle that it's been found in. They found it in a herd in Texas, originally in the panhandle. And they think possibly that it was transmitted by bird feces in the feed. But anyhow, it doesn't kill the cattle. The symptoms of it in cattle is they'll get lethargic and their milk production goes down. They have a fever and then, but they overcome it. You know, it doesn't kill them. They come back from it. But one of the things is a concern among the public is, what about milk? And USDA is sure, and we can rest assured, that our milk supply is safe, that the pasteurization process kills the virus. And so there's no possibility, at least as determined so far, of being transferred through the milk. Now, they do, if they analyze the milk, they can find the DNA remnants of the virus, but it's not alive. It's not contagious. It doesn't pass on this flu problem to anything else. Now, the one thing you'd have to be careful of if you drink raw milk, because it can be transferred in raw milk. And so keep that in mind. And FDA and USDA and CDC and a number of people that are trying to protect us are involved in this. And so they assess this, if they find anything, through what's called an egg inoculation test, which is the gold standard for determining and if an infectious virus is present. And there have been no results that indicate that that has passed on through pasteurized milk. And so, you know, we want to support our dairy farmers, and there's no reason for us to quit drinking milk because of this. And sometimes ill-informed people pass on the wrong message. So I just wanted to make everyone aware of that. All right, this is an interesting question. Someone's asked, I'm interested in getting pheasants. How will they do ranging, or do I need to keep them in a coop? Well, keep in mind that pheasants are wild birds. And so we can raise pheasants, and some people do raise pheasants around here, both of different kinds. For example, ringneck pheasants. There's been multiple efforts to try to stock ringneck pheasants in this part of the world. And we can raise them, but if you turn them loose, they're not going to survive long. You know, if you raise grouse and turn them loose, they'd have a better chance. But ringnecks, for example, the habitat is not here for them for the most part. They live out in the West, where there's different kind of grasses and so forth that are more common that they can hide and nest in. So if I was going to raise them, I would figure out some way to keep them in a coop if I wanted to get anything out of the pheasants. Now, if you're raising them for hunting, that might be a different situation, where you might want to turn those pheasants loose a little while before you wanted to hunt. But I would just be careful if I expected them, if I turned them loose, to be there next year because of the foxes and coyotes and so forth. So it's a good question, though. All right, another question. This is on an entirely different topic. This is kind of potpourri today as far as topics go. Is I get regularly get a question about moss control in lawns. And mosses can be a problem. They're not very attractive in a lawn. If you go out in the woods and you see them growing on a dead log or something, that's one thing. But if you see them in your yard, they're certainly not attractive. They're not very resilient. If you walk on them or twist your foot on them or something, then you've got a bare place. But they're a non-vascular plant, which means they don't have any xylem or phloem tubes like you would see in a grass or another broadleaf plant. And that's a significant part of it that you need to know. And so there, the fact that mosses don't have this vascular system, it represents one of the big challenges in managing mosses, because you can't use systemic herbicides like Roundup or 2,4-D or some of those, because there's no vascular system to translocate the herbicide. And infestations of moss and turf are usually associated with unfavorable conditions for growing healthy turf. And that's what we need to realize. If we can keep healthy, dense turf, then mosses are, in almost all cases, not going to be a problem. And some of those unfavorable conditions that favor the moss are low fertility, or poorly drained soils, or low pH, or excessively wet soils, or soil compaction, just things that we wouldn't want anyhow if we wanted a good solid turf. And so they're very competitive in cool, moist, and shaded areas. And so we have to correct the problem before we can get rid of the moss. You know, we can remove the moss, but if we don't solve whatever was favoring it, then we're probably not going to get rid of it. If we need to improve the pH or the fertility or relieve some of the shade, then we're going to have to do something about that before we really correct the problem. And so, you know, planting shade-tolerant grasses is one thing, keeping sure nitrogen fertility in the turf is adequate. And that goes along with soil testing. We need to meet those other fertilizer needs as well as any lime needs that the yard might have. And then aerifying. We talked about that on our when we were talking about turf, actually doing core aerification, where we're giving some space in the soil for the grass to thrive. And so if you do have moss and you want to kill it, the product that you could use for that would either be copper or iron sulfate, sprayed at 3 to 5 ounces per 1,000 square feet in 4 gallons of water. Let me say that again. That's copper or iron sulfate sprayed in at 3 to 5 ounces per 1,000 square feet in 4 gallons of water. And, you know, when we do that, we need to be sure that we allow it to die. And then we have to get rid of the moss. And then if we're worried about the sulfate molecules changing the pH, we can put down about 5 to 10 pounds of ground limestone per 1,000 square feet before we seed. That will help neutralize that. And so, you know, keep that in mind if you have it. You have to get rid of it before you sow the grass back. So that's one of the things that we have to do. All right. We've got another question.
You do. I just got this one in, and it says, is there a non-chemical mean of cleaning that green stuff off the side of a house?
You know, the only non-chemical way that I would know to do that would be physically. Either we scrub it off or we take a high-pressure washer and spray it off. As far as an organic way of doing that or a non-chemical way of doing that, I'm not aware of one. There are products out there that you can use to get rid of some of those problems like that, but obviously they're chemicals. And so if you've got a high-pressure washer, we can force it off or we can scrub it off. A high-pressure washer would probably be easier. So no, I'm not aware of a non-chemical way of getting rid of it. All right. Another one I get pretty frequently, it's beginning this time of the year and then up into the summer, is problems with grapes. And there's a couple of diseases that affect grapes that frustrate people. They've had a grapevine for years and used to get grapes all the time. And now every summer, it seems almost just when the grapes are about to get ripe, they rot. And there's two diseases that cause that. One of those is black rot, and the other one is called botrytis bunch rot. And both of those end up with the grapes being rotten before you can eat them. With black rot, it may not be all the grapes, but it may be several of them that will start out with a reddish-brown spot on it, and then it'll be circled by a dark brown ring, and then those spots get bigger, and ultimately the grape is whole grape is affected, and maybe several bunch grapes in the bunch. And then they dry up and mummify, and those mummies, or what we might call a raisin, give off spores that infect the rest of the vine. The botrytis bunch rot, in that case, the grapes will turn brown and they'll have the mycelia or the fuzzy part of the mold growing on them. Now, that can be controlled. I mean, there are some products out there that will control that. For example, with black rot, Immunox, which has mycobutanil in it, which is it's a spectracide product, or Mancozeb, both do a good job of controlling black rot. With botrytis, Captan does a good job of controlling that. And the process of doing that is not a once and done thing. If you're going, you're going to have to commit yourself to a spray schedule if you're going to control that in your grapes, or you're just going to have to leave it to chance and say, maybe I'll get grapes this year, maybe I won't. But we have a spray schedule for that, and it really starts back when the new shoots begin to grow. So we're just a little bit behind that right now. The grapes are leafing out. But when the new shoots are about 1 to 2 inches long is really when we start treating that. And we're going to treat for those, you know, when the shoots are longer, when we get bloom, before they bloom, when the after they bloom, when the grapes are pea size, and then when the grapes begin to touch in the cluster. So it's a season-long process. And some of the things we want to do in that same process is use some materials that keep us from having insect damage, because some of these diseases can be a problem where there's injuries on the plant, and insects tend to do that. Even other diseases can predispose the plant to it, like powdery mildew. And so, you know, we have those spray schedules in the office. I can get those to you. I'm not going to bore you with reading it to you here on the air. But it's not difficult to do. It just takes a commitment to be able to do that. Do we have any more questions, Ivy?
Well, we got just a couple minutes. We do have another question. And first of all, Phil, I just want to thank you for taking time each week to be here for Farm Talk. You've been Washington County Agricultural Extension agent for many years, and this is a public and community service. And we're happy that you're willing to share your knowledge and try to answer questions. So if you're out there listening in and want to know something, don't hesitate to ask. You can email Phil at pblevins@vt.edu or call the radio station 276-944-6933. And I told you that today was Stump the Ag Agent.
We've already done that once with the crepe myrtle.
Well, I think we have just the perfect one to take us out today. So see if you know the answer to this. If a chicken and a half takes a day and a half to lay an egg and a half, how long does it take a cricket with a wooden leg to kick all the seeds out of a dill pickle?
I'll have to pass on that one. Since there's not a chicken and a half that can lay an egg and a half, I'm going to say that's not possible.
Well, you've been listening to Farm Talk. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday for another edition. This is WEHC Emory and WISE FM Wise.